morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C. The presidential candidate for the ruling All Progressives Congress launches an action plan his campaign says will make Nigeria great.
The Tinubu administration plans to, for instance, expand the armed forces in terms of number. A lot of technology will be introduced into the security architecture of our country.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa expresses support for the independence of Western Sahara.
Even before the independence, ANC has been very committed to the struggle of Western Sahara. They recognize our government. It's extremely, extremely important to have the support of a country like South Africa just because of its position in the international scene.
And South Africa's former President Jacob Zuma is alleging the country's justice system is unjust. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, the presidential candidate for the ruling All Progressives Congress, or APC, has launched an action plan his campaign says will make Nigeria great. His campaign team says the 80-page document prioritizes national security, economy, agriculture, power, oil and gas, transportation and education. Tinubu says he will continue the good works of outgoing President Muhammadu Buhari, who promises to campaign for the former Lagos State governor. Critics, however, say growing insecurity and poor prevailing economic conditions should be a warning to prospective voters not to elect Tinubu as Nigeria's next president. For details about Tinubu's action plan for Nigeria, I reach Bayo Onanuga. He is a spokesman of Tinubu's Presidential Campaign Council.
Well, it's a 10-point plan that covers the gamut of problems that are today confronting our country, from economy to security to education and to a whole lot of problems, and to youth empowerment, problems of unemployment and so on. That's what the document touches. And it's a well-thought-out program because Mr. Tinubu, before he came out with the document, consulted very widely. He carried the party and all stakeholders along. He spoke to the experts in various ways before the document came out.
So what specific measures do you think the presidential candidate will implement that will see the actualization of this 80-page action plan to transform the lives of Nigerians, if I may ask you?
Well, there are so many specific measures. For instance, security. The Tinubu administration, when elected by the grace of God, will plans to, for instance, expand the armed forces in terms of number, recruit more qualified Nigerians to join the army, to join the air force, to join the navy, to join the police, to join the civil defense, so that you can have, because when you look at it, look at the police. We have fewer than 400,000 police in Nigeria today. The number is very, very inadequate to take care of our security. The Tinubu administration wants to expand it. And in the manifesto, we are talking about community policing. From 2023, a lot of technology will be introduced into the security architecture of our country.
You just mentioned the Bola Ahmed Tinubu will continue the work of outgoing President Muhammadu Buhari, but his critics say that the present administration has, under the leadership of the APC, the ruling party, has failed. They talk about enormous socioeconomic challenges and poor security, prevailing security climate with banditry, Islamic terror attack. The APC has failed to effectively run the administration of the country. So Nigerians should not make the second mistake of re-voting for the APC. That means not voting for Tinubu in the February presidential election. How do you respond to such criticism?
The narrative you just gave, that is the narrative of the opposition. And I tell you, it's a fallacy. It's not true. It doesn't match the reality on the ground. You see, what has happened is that from 2015, when the APC administration came on board, the losers have done everything possible not to acknowledge any good thing that this government has done. They always harp on the negatives without even looking at the brighter side. The what I would call the silver linings that everybody can see it, that people can see that this government has achieved. Yes, we are not saying we're not facing challenges, but what we are saying is that the incoming APC administration, we try as much as possible to wrestle with all of these problems and to give Nigeria a better country.
What makes Mr. Tinubu uniquely qualified to become the Nigeria's next president? And will he be ready day one if Nigerians were to repose confidence in him to run the affairs of the country? Because his critics are saying he will learn on the job and that he doesn't have the requisite skill apart from running the office of the Lagos state as a governor. He does not have what it takes to become the president of Nigeria. How do you respond to that?
No, on the contrary, of all the people who have asked Nigerians to vote for them to be president, he's the only one who has the track record. He's the only one who has the track record of all of them. Mr. Atiku has never governed a state before. He, as VP of Nigeria, that he was just a mere spare tire. He was not an agent. I'm not saying that he was even asked to do by his principal of Basenjo. He messed up in those things. Mr. Obi, he was a failure as governor of Anambra State. He didn't do so well. But Mr. Tinubu is the only one who has a track record, a standing record, as a performer, as a governor.
Bayo Onanuga is a spokesman of Tinubu's Presidential Campaign Council. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Nigerian youth-led groups say they applaud their peers who are using the End SARS campaign to voice their concerns and are urging youth to keep the same attitude as the West African nation approaches its presidential elections that are set for the 25th of February. For more viewers, Mike Hovey spoke to Ojoolua Ibiloye, the founder of Rural Pro Nigeria, a non-partisan organization that focuses on promoting local governance rooted in citizens' participation.
The 2023 general elections in Nigeria is a very important exercise that the young people are showing serious interest in, more than the previous elections. And it just concluded continuous voters registration exercise by the Independent National Electoral Commission. INEC just registered about 12.2 million new voters. That took the number up from 84 million registered voters in 2019. Now we currently have 95 million registered voters. So it means about 12 million people registered to participate in the 2023 elections to add up with the existing figures. Mm-hmm. And out of the 12.2 million, about 7.8 are under the age of 30. In 2020, millions of Nigerian youths started a social movement against police brutality in the country. We said to ourselves, enough is enough. We need police reform in the country. We took to the streets and used social media to amplify our voices. We are taking the success of the End SARS protest forward. We are now going to protest through the ballot to elect the right candidates.
Having young people, having women in government could be the answer that the young people are looking for. But in Nigeria's circumstance, you'll find that both groups are part of the minority when we're talking about representation in government. What is your thought on that, and how do you remedy such a situation?
Young people are not interested in party politics, and political parties are the gateways to political participation in the country. Although we have achieved independent candidacy, but it is still not a reality without the backing and the support of a political party.
You briefly touched on young people being never being too young to run. Now, earlier on, you referred to the Not Too Young to Run bill that was signed by President Buhari in 2018. Do you think that that bill is something that's going to lead to some kind of change next year?
The achievement of 2018, the Not Too Young to Run bill, really paved the way for young Nigerians to aspire and stand the chance to contest for positions in this country, Nigeria. For instance, a 25-year-old can contest for a seat in the Nigerian House of Representatives. And in 2019, the Speaker of Oyo State House of Assembly won the election when he was just around below 35. This is something that before the Not Too Young to Run bill was very difficult.
Ojooluwa Ibiloye is the founder of Rural Pro Nigeria. He spoke to my colleague Mike Hovey via Skype from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, says lessons learned from the global coronavirus pandemic and Ebola have left it better prepared for the future. Officials of the CDC say health diplomacy significantly helped African countries during the outbreak. It comes as African health experts push for the continent to produce vaccines to protect against future pandemics. This as African countries complain that wealthier nations were slow to share access to vaccines to control COVID-19. Dr. Benjamin Judelbai is the head of policy, health, diplomacy, and communication at the Africa CDC. In a part one of the Skype interview with me, he talked about the value of diplomacy and the role of the Africa CDC in post-pandemic recovery and in future pandemics. Here is the concluding part of the interview with the head of policy, health, diplomacy, and communication at the Africa CDC.
You spoke about the 1% of vaccine produced in Africa. Recently, some are saying that even though some vaccines are being produced on the continent, the 1%, Africans are not patronizing it, and that they prefer to get it from outside than in Africa. So how do you work to ensure that they collaborate together, they boost production so people can get them quite easily from the continent?
Yes, we are conscious about that challenge. And that challenge is being addressed today. Last year, in June 2021, the head of state, under their leadership, they launched, not only they hosted a big vaccine manufacturing conference for the continent, but they also established what we call the PAVM, the Partnership for Vaccine Manufacturing on the Continent. And the role of this partnership, which is hosted now as a secretariat at the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is to ensure that all the challenges you highlighted are addressed one after another. So we are working on that one. And there is a big also framework called the Pharmaceutical Manufacturing Plan for Africa, which identify all the bottlenecks, for the manufacturing of all the medical products, including vaccines, therapeutics, on the continent. So we are working toward that one, and the come into force of the AMA treaty will also help in terms of regulatory environment, because one of the big challenges that we have identified in terms of medical manufacturing on the continent is also the regulatory aspects. So now these different challenges are being addressed, and I am sure and I'm confident that in the next future, we will be able to manufacture on the continent so that we are self-reliant.
Before we go, looking at the agenda for Africa's preparation for towards the next pandemic, what role do you think health diplomacy can play in actualizing this plan and making it effective and work for all Africans?
The most important for us in Africa, the health diplomacy was playing a big role. And I will give you a concrete example. What happened during the COVID-19, and this is the part we are going to continue on that one. I will give you not only one, but two recent examples. When COVID started and was declared a public health emergency of international concern by WHO in January 2020, Africa CDC and African Union Commission convened all the ministers of health of the continent in Addis Ababa, to do two things. First, to have one strategy for the continent. And we successfully did that. One strategy for coronavirus on the continent. We established a continental task force, bringing all the member states together, bringing all the partners working in Africa together. And we had technical working groups under continental task force on coronavirus. So this is how all the negotiations were conducted. Everything was done, all the technical documents, everything was done at that level. So it is a very participatory process. It means health diplomacy, negotiations, since we were not alone, we brought all the partners together under the leadership of the African Union as one. That is extremely important. So speaking in one voice, coordinating our common positions, that is extremely important. The second example that I want to give you is the during the recent Ebola, the ongoing Ebola outbreak in Uganda. What we did is to work with the country in Uganda to bring we had a high-level ministerial meeting on preparedness and response, for Ebola outbreak in Uganda last week. All the ministers, of the neighboring countries of Uganda were there, and also two other ministers from other regions of Africa joined. These are, the ministers of health of Liberia and the ministers of health of Sierra Leone, who came also to share the lesson learned during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. So moving forward, that will be our modus operandi. We are going to work like that, and we have this convening power, as African Union, to bring all the stakeholders around the table, harmonize our position, to communicate, to coordinate, and to work together. So that is the way we see health diplomacy at work at the African Union Commission, at Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Dr. Benjamin Judelbai is the head of policy, health, diplomacy, and communication at the Africa CDC. He spoke with me from the Gabonese capital, Libreville. In South Africa, the Polisario Front says it is grateful for the support from President Cyril Ramaphosa and the governing African National Congress, or ANC. The front is working to end Morocco's control of Western Sahara. Local media reports Ramaphosa are saying he supports the region's independence and called for pressure from the international community to ensure the long-delayed referendum for self-determination by the people is carried out. This after Ramaphosa hosted Brahim Gali, leader of the Polisario Front, at the Union Building in South Africa's capital, Pretoria. The visit, officials say, was aimed at deepening bilateral relations. South Africa officially recognized Western Sahara on September 15, 2004. For the latest development on South Africa's support for the Liberation Group and the region's people, I reach Mouloud Saïd. He is the representative of the Polisario Front in Washington, D.C.
The highest kind of visit that a head of state can make to another country. So, and this is just something normal that, as you know, it's not something new, but the ANC and the Polisario Front, they are two sister organizations that we have been together, in the fight together for so many years. And so there is this alliance between the Polisario Front and the ANC and between the Sahrawi Republic and the South African Republic. So this is something for anybody who knows the history of the two, of Polisario and the ANC, they know that we are the two sister organizations. So we're very happy that this visit did happen. And we're also very grateful for the government of South Africa, the people of South Africa and the ANC for hosting our president during this state visit.
How important or how significant is South Africa's support?
I mean, there is nothing strange on that because South Africa, even before the independence, ANC has been very committed to the struggle of Western Sahara, and since the end of the apartheid, and Mandela himself, he has expressed his full support for the Sahrawi people, and they recognized our government. One of the first steps that the new South Africa did was to recognize the Sahrawi government and to express support that has been very, very firm. And for us, it's extremely, extremely important to have the support of a country like South Africa, just because, not only because of its history, but also because of its position in the international scenes. So we are very happy about the development of our relation with South Africa, and we believe that's going to be a plus to our struggle. And so we believe, as you know, South Africa is not just any country. I mean, this is an extremely important country in Africa and in the rest of the world.
The president of South Africa also called for dialogue between the Polisario Front or the Sahrawi people and the Moroccan authorities to try to resolve any misunderstanding or any tensions between the two, to resolve issues concerning self-determination. Morocco appears displeased by the stance of South Africa. So how can you resolve this tension if Morocco is displeased and you are happy?
Yeah, the thing is that, you know, the fact that the president of South Africa called for the negotiation between the two parties, this is something that the Sahrawi leadership has been calling for a long time. And this is the call that the United Nations made so many times, you know, for the parties to negotiate, sit down around the table. But because of the lack of will from the Moroccan side, the United Nations did not succeed. This is one of the reasons why even Secretary James Baker, when he was the envoy, he had to resign because of the lack of will from Morocco. The Moroccans, they don't want to have any solution that may lead to a peaceful solution, which will take care of the self-determination of the people of Western Sahara.
But Morocco seemed to be having a lot of support internationally, that self-determination should be held within the context of how Morocco organizes it and moving forward. Why don't you find a common ground in order to resolve this tension? Because if this is not resolved, self-determination might be difficult to achieve.
So why we didn't give up on the apartheid and let the apartheid just keep on South Africa? I mean, this is it doesn't make any sense. You know, we are in a world that's supposed to be ruled by international law, you know? So it's very clear that Western Sahara does not belong to Morocco. Why we don't make pressure on Morocco to make sure that Sahrawis enjoy their right instead of supporting an illegal occupation? People are now trying to protest about the occupation of Ukraine. Why we don't just leave Russia and take that part that they want in that case? You cannot have double standards, you know, wherever, when you say that they will have the support. The Americans have been giving support to Morocco since day one. In fact, the Moroccans, the U.S. encouraged Morocco to occupy Western Sahara, so nothing has changed in the U.S. position. The U.S. position has been, but take into consideration the position of Africa, the African unity. The organizations, they are fully supporting the Sahara Republic. We are member, as an independent country, we are member of the African Union. According to the African Union, Morocco is illegally occupying a member state, an independent member state of the African Union. So we don't have to look just to the position of Washington, but we have to look at the position of Africa. This is an African problem, and we cannot undermine Africa.
Mouloud Said is the representative of the Polisario Front in Washington, D.C. He spoke with me from Madrid, Spain. Africa's scandal-laden former President Jacob Zuma addressed the media Saturday for the first time after completing a jail term for contempt of court, alleging the country's justice system is unjust and infiltrated by foreign interests. For VOA, Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, who has faced a myriad of corruption allegations, is calling the country's court system unjust. Zuma spoke for the first time Saturday after completing a 15-month sentence in recent weeks for a contempt of court conviction. He had failed to appear in front of an inquiry into state graft, locally called state capture, that occurred under his nearly decade-long tenure. Yet Zuma told the press he had been unfairly imprisoned without a trial, despite the fact he was summoned and failed to appear before the inquiry. Analysts say Zuma is refusing to acknowledge the validity of the inquiry, essentially attempting to portray the presiding judge as leading a witch hunt for the former leader. Zuma said the country's court system had been, quote, infiltrated, unquote, by both international interests and the interests of sympathizers of the former racially segregated apartheid regime. Zuma also claimed the judge presiding over the inquiry, Chief Justice Raymond Zondo, had unfairly targeted him and his allies to distract the public from the country's real issues. At the time of his arrest in July 2021, protests led by his supporters in his home province of KwaZulu-Natal spiraled into riots around the country that resulted in millions of dollars in damage to infrastructure and stolen goods. Police said earlier this week that one of Zuma's daughters remains under investigation for inciting the unrest. Zuma spent just 3 of the 15 months behind bars, and he was released on medical parole for an undisclosed condition. On Saturday, Zuma didn't provide any evidence of so-called infiltration of the country's courts, which are viewed by many as the strongest institution for averting otherwise widespread corruption. Instead, Zuma blamed but didn't name the country's leadership for selling out the judiciary and the constitution to, quote, global commercial interests, unquote. These allegations come just 2 months ahead of the convention of the ruling African National Congress Party, where current president Cyril Ramaphosa, who is politically at odds with his predecessor Zuma, is expected to face fierce competition to retain party leadership. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. World Soccer governing body FIFA on Saturday conducted the draws for the 2023 Women's World Cup that will be co-hosted by Australia and New Zealand. The four African nations at next year's FIFA Women's World Cup have been handed tough opponents at the tournament, with nine-time African champions Nigeria, who have featured at every edition of the tournament, playing Australia, Republic of Ireland, and reigning Olympic gold winners Canada. Banyana of South Africa, who won their first African title in the recent CAF Women's African Cup of Nations, will face tricky opponents in Group G as they will battle Sweden, Italy, and Argentina. Natasha Chiselas, vice president of the South African Football Association, is confident that the South Africans can be the top performer in their group.
We as champions of Africa, I'm sure the same minute, the same moment now, other countries after the draw, they're talking about South Africa as well. And we are very strong opponent to any other country.
First-timers Zambia are in Group C to face European giants Spain, former world champions Japan, and Costa Rica, while debutant Morocco will slug it out with Germany, Colombia, and Korea Republic in Group H. On the other hand, Senegal and Cameroon will look to snatch two of the three playoff spots in the 10-nation tournament in February 2023. Staying with football news, an interim management committee has been constituted to run the Nigerian Professional Football League, otherwise known as the NPFL. Shortly after the inauguration of the 13-man team, the chairman of the committee, Benga Elegbeleye, said the committee will do all within its powers to bring sanity to the running of the football league in Nigeria. He called on all football stakeholders to find a lasting solution that will make Nigerian league one of the best in the world. He promised not to compromise on standards, saying the committee within its 3 months lifespan will deliver a league that every Nigerian will be proud of.
Club owners should ensure standard best practices, good pitches, players' welfare, and we must ensure again that football matches are back on television.
In golf news, the 2022 Uganda Amateur Golf Open was concluded on Saturday. Andrew Sikibija emerged champion after he tallied a total of 300 strokes gross in grueling 72 holes action. Defending champion Joseph Siwiyawi was 9 strokes behind the leaderboard to claim the third position. Staying in East Africa, the Zone 5 International Handball Federation will begin on Monday at the Nyanyo National Stadium and at the Ulinzi Sports Complex in Kenya. A total of 20 teams from 10 countries are expected to participate in the qualifying tournament set to run from the 24th to the 30th of October 2022. And that is all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Now that it has been confirmed that representatives of the government of Ethiopia and the leadership of the TPLF will meet tomorrow in South Africa to commence peace talks, Africa will be watching closely the progress of these negotiations. No one should be in illusion that the talks will be easy. Rather, it will be difficult and protracted. Contemporary practitioners of the pursuit of peaceful settlement of disputes and negotiations are tending to pick low-hanging fruits and tackle only the immediate problems that lead to the start of war. This is a serious problem, because to do so will be to ignore the deep underlying factors that fuel the dispute in the first place. What is required is a compact, wide-ranging examination of the underlying issues to resolve and reach a stable peace. I say this as one official of the United Nations who was involved in all the negotiations before the Dirk was defeated, through the transition, and years after. I can affirm that there are many difficult underlying issues which have not been discussed publicly, either by the media or the parties, that may be needed some attention. What the parties should do now, once all other arrangements have been completed, is to take the first phase, that is the conclusion of ceasefire and cease movements that are going to be supervised by either a party, third party, or other third parties. An additional suppression of forces agreement may be useful, but not necessarily essential. Once peace ceasefire had been achieved, the next step should be the negotiators must try to make arrangements for the arrangement for creating measures for confidence building so that the parties can have a stable foundation for peace. When that too is completed, then the parties could go through the difficult issues I mentioned above. It is also necessary to note that those who have been called to observe these negotiations should play a useful role, but they must be very nimble. They should not use any heavy-handed methods to sway one side or the other, because that will be counterproductive. Now, once the talks continue, Africa and the rest of the world will be watching to see how far progress could be made. Let's give them all encouragement to pursue peace. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
corner and I'm never, never, never alone. You've been gone too long, Mpulu Mpulu Hati, baby, come home. I know you think it's over, but it's saying, baby, come over. Gikondugu tiguwe, yimu selusana. Gikondugu tiguwe, yimu satandwa. I ain't going nowhere, baby. I ain't going nowhere, baby. Ngiyabonga.
See, I don't wanna talk about na we maleri mechi kuvira. See, I don't know what on to my corner, we maleri mechi kuvira.
I'm a bit rough around the edges, baby, yes. I keep it happy and I do what make me happy. And nobody can deny me that I'm blessed. I might be rough around the edges, baby, yes. I keep it happy and I do what make me happy. And nobody can deny me that I'm blessed.
So tonight I'm feeling blessed, oh. Say tonight me and my guys by now. Oh, I don't wanna be my life for you, live my life for you. All over the news, all over the news. Only God now, you know the kind of thing I do, the kind of thing we do. Man, I thank God I got the lead. Say God no ungodly. Oluwa now comforting me. When these people they come body me, man, I thank God I got the lead. Say God oh ungodly. Oh do one ain't comforting me. When these people they come body me, it's why I die sometimes. A little henny and ice. You've been the one, my love. Diamond walk a molly. Chinelin and wash the coli. Only the guy is in KC. Kimball like a coli. Your ex-man like an enemy funny and I got it to me. Mong I'm telling you to my saying goodbye. I'm different thing funny boobie. Yes, a song song. Marang nandaba. I can put you on. Wanna go nyala. Tangle in the moth. Speaking up a share, see him all in my land. Baby, want me. As little no more, no, my kid, one next week. Better tell him it's more than love, this time and see. Lord, lie, belly super. Beg it when I wait, one more never look back. I shall pass, it's all belong to me. Cause you know, want you, when you talk to me, baby. Eba si fuga de shutando do quele, quele ba pega e si tele, ou si quele uma vumizinge. I think it's sad, sad. I think it's sad, sad. I think it's sad, sad. Itando la oke, shela mina ngawe ngikwele, nyamche. Sange bang fagu moya ngawe ngaife, la mangi tinya puma nyufuna masen. Kuse wena nomde ni wamin betese, kala ngifu.
Jerusalem, ikayala mi, bilondoloze. Ikayalami, ilondoloze,
Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington.
Direct from Washington, the Voice of America, VOA.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, it is the wandering dog that finds the old bull. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Good evening.